You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When Barney Frank retired from politics in 2013, he'd spent over 30 years representing his Massachusetts district in Congress, and he'd also witnessed a dramatic social transformation that touched him personally.
Frank became the first member of Congress to voluntarily come out as gay in 1987. In 2012, he became the first to enter a same-sex marriage. That year, a poll in his district showed he was more popular for being married than for championing major financial reform legislation, the Dodd-Frank bill, the very thing that had made Frank question whether he could succeed in government at all in the 1960s. His sexuality was now more popular than his work as a politician.
Frank charts that transformation from a personal and political perspective in his new memoir, Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. He joins us now. Representative Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, you highlight a couple of major trends that you saw over your years in office. One strand of this is the public's opinion of government, and the other, the public's acceptance of the LGBT community. How have those perceptions changed during your career?
When I started, actually, I was 14 when I began to think about getting into politics. That was 1954, and it was very clear to me then that I had to choose between a public career and a personal life, because being a homosexual, as we then all called it, was something that was universally despised. I would note to Ben Carson, with his incredibly stupid comment that sexual orientation is a choice, that as a teenager, I was not likely to choose to be one of the most despised people I could think of. So I thought, well, you know, I want to be in politics. There were things I want to do. I was appalled by the murder of Emmett Till, who was my age, 1954. I got some negative inspiration from a Wisconsinite, Senator Joseph McCarthy. I watched the Army McCarthy hearings. I saw his sneering and his bullying and the ability of other people to use the law to hold him in check. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I guess I'll just have to deny my own sexuality and not act on it because the two are incompatible. And as time went on, actually when I first ran for office, I kind of made a deal with myself. It was 1972. I ran for the state legislature. I was convinced I could not be elected if I was out publicly. At the same time, I said it would be just despicable to be a gay man and not be in support of other gay people. So I decided right away that I would unfortunately be a coward, but I would not be a hypocrite. And I became a very active advocate of gay rights from the very beginning. So what then happens is I see being gay or lesbian, bisexual, going up in the public esteem as we come out, as we defeat the prejudice. But for a variety of reasons, beginning in the 80s, government goes down. And so I kind of watch those two trends pass each other.
It's an interesting journey to have been on, and you were part of it yourself. You made history, in a sense, when you came out as gay in 1987. You were the first member of Congress to do so voluntarily. I guess a book was going to come out that was going to provide a clue about your sexuality. What was going through your mind then as you considered
taking this?
Well,
actually, the book had come out a year before. A guy named Robert Bauman, who was one of these gay hypocrites who had was having a very active sex life with teenage young men and at the same time voting to condemn gay rights. And he wrote a book which hinted at it, but the press at the time was of the mindset that unless you were involved in some scandal, they would mention it. So that came and went. What went through my mind was that I did not want to live the way I was living, repressing my personal life. I tried to say, okay, I'll be a public figure and I'll be sort of neutral sexually, but in private I'll live as a gay man. But that doesn't work. The more prominent I became, the harder it was to maintain a decent social life as a closeted person. I've heard people say, well, you know, a good career can be a substitute for private life. That's nonsense. Most people have physical and emotional needs that have to be satisfied. And so by 1987, I thought it was likely that I could come out and survive it politically, but I also was so angry at myself for the repression I was imposing on myself and the irresponsible ways I was acting to cope with it, that I said, I'm coming out, and if it ruins my career, I'll regret that. But I've got to live. Fortunately, it worked out better. Of course, as you know, in Madison, I was the first to come out voluntarily. I was followed 11 years later by Tammy Baldwin, who was very importantly the first person to be out before she was elected, and that was another major breakthrough.
Right, you're not the first one anymore, but you were.
Well,
back
it was
then.
Different. I mean, I was I was the first to volunteer that I was gay once I had safely been elected. You know, Tammy did something that in many ways was tougher. She identified as a lesbian before the election.
Now, you've said that there are still closeted gays in Congress. Why do you think that?
Mostly because, there are two categories. There are a couple of older Democrats, I believe, and you know, if you've been hiding from people all your life, and even at 47, I kind of encountered this, it just becomes hard to talk to people close to you and say, by the way, I haven't been honest with you. Generally, people know it. But that's only a couple of people, I think, maybe just one. On the Republican side, it's very clear. Those of us who've been out in Congress or in other political jobs as Democrats, like the new governor of Oregon, like Tammy, like six other members of the House right now, we are generally strongly supported by the Democrats. The Democratic Party has become the pro-LGBT equality party. The Republicans became the anti-party. And even though they're not as aggressive about it now because they know it's bad politics, the fact is that if you are a gay Republican, I say gay because there are not many lesbian Republicans at all. Lesbians have a double problem with the Republican Party as women and as gay people. But they're not very happy for you. In fact, in a couple of cases, very able gay Republicans were kind of forced out of office. I'll give you one example. By primary opponents, when Tom DeLay had to leave the House of Representatives, the candidate to succeed him, picked by the Speaker, Dennis Hastert, was David Dreyer, who was very able, very smart chairman of the Rules Committee, and he was named Majority Leader. And a number of the Republicans said, we can't have him, he's gay. He was widely thought to be a closeted gay man. And within a couple of hours, the Speaker withdrew his designation. Actually, the interesting point was that they said, oh, well, we withdrew him because he was too moderate. In fact, he was quite conservative. And I was asked at the time by the press corps in the lobby off the House floor if I agreed that David Dreyer had been removed from the leadership because he was too moderate. And I said yes, in the sense that after the moderate pride parade last summer, I went to a moderate bar.
Well, being gay is kind of a unique position to be in. If you're a woman, if you're an African-American, you can't run for office as a white man and then come out once you're elected. So do you think that the gay people in politics have a kind of responsibility to other gay people to come out?
I think there's a strong argument for coming out. Look, and I maybe this is self-exculpatory. I think it's easier now. When I first ran in 72, I think I would have had to choose between being elected. And in fact, I started by the late 70s. I was starting to come out. I was coming out on a retail basis to friends, getting ready to do it publicly. And then I got a chance to run for Congress, interestingly, I suppose, to people, because the Pope decided that the liberal Jesuit priest next door to me shouldn't be a congressman anymore. And when he told them he couldn't run, that gave me a chance to run. The priest, Father Drinan, who died just a couple of years ago, was a great anti-war liberal, did say that he was sorry he never got to see the Pope, who made him leave Congress to be replaced by me, because he wanted to ask the Pope if it had worked out exactly as he had planned. But I could not have been elected that way. I did come out about as soon as I thought I could. And the answer is this. Look, we didn't create the prejudice. No one is obligated morally to expose himself or herself to prejudice. I do say that it is morally despicable for anyone who is gay or lesbian to vote and support policies that are anti. And there have been a number of Republicans who have done that. And I believe that there's a right to privacy, but it does not translate into the right to be a hypocrite. Beyond that, if you can come out, there's obviously a value to it. And at least in my own case, I decided, look, if I got to choose between maintaining the kind of implicit dishonesty, I never said I was straight, but I was not being honest about being gay. If I had to choose, I was going to choose honesty.
So looking at some other areas of what you write about, you did tell the Daily Beast that the perception has been that liberal politicians have been too busy with women and gays and blacks to attract the votes of working class white men. What do you mean by that?
I don't think that's accurate, by the way. I think that, as I reported to the reporter, that was the perception. Here's the deal. And I think we are frustrated, many of us on the liberal side, by the white men who vote for Scott Walker, who's trying to bust unions, who's trying to do things, unfortunately, sometimes succeeding, that are bad for them economically. White men who don't support efforts to make it easier to get higher education. You cut back on the University of Wisconsin and white working class people lose a chance to send their kids to a school that'll give them that first-rate education and equip them better. And so I thought about why. There was for a while a view that, well, we're losing white guys because they don't like support Democrats for gay people or abortion, et cetera. I don't think that's true. We do have a problem with gun regulation, but mostly I think, look, the country's gone more and more pro-gay, and I don't think abortion has been a big electoral issue, even while white guys have been more and more alienated. And I think the point is this. Since the 70s, national and international economic trends have worked to the disadvantage of white men. Bill Clinton helped retard that disadvantage a little bit. But in general, the white men who in the 50s, 60s, and 70s could go to work on an auto plant or a steel plant and make a good living, that's gone away from them. And they are disappointed that the Democrats, who they correctly see as the party that's generally for government activism, hasn't supported them. Now, I believe they incorrectly think that's because we have been too worried about some of these other groups. I don't think that's a fact. As I said, that's the perception. The problem is that we're in a vicious cycle. A lot of white guys are angry at the government because it has not responded to their economic position. So they show that anger by voting for the people who are anti-government. And when the people who are anti-government take over, they then make it even harder for us to do the kind of things we'd like to do, like supporting unions or raising the minimum wage or increasing public construction, hire construction workers. So my proposals in the book are, and I believe this is the central point that I see it, if we could find the money to have the government do more for higher education across the board, to absorb more of people's educational costs, to do more infrastructure and put more construction people to work, to hire people at the city level to do a lot of those things that would be so welcome to people. If we had the money to do that, government would be popular again. The question is, how do you get that money when people wouldn't vote for anybody to raise taxes? So I have two very important proposals. First, I believe it is essential that we substantially reduce America's military budget. If we hadn't gone into that foolish and mistaken war in Iraq, we'd have $1 trillion that we could have spent over these years that could have helped reduce the deficit and also improve social programs. Secondly, it's time to stop locking people up because they use recreational drugs that other people don't approve of. If you're taking a substance that makes you likely to injure other people, we ought to regulate that, although it's probably too late to prohibit alcohol, which is the number one drug that makes people misbehave. But to lock people up because they use marijuana, to lock people up because they use cocaine. Using cocaine doesn't make you violent. What makes people violent is trying to get those things. If we could cut military spending to our legitimate military needs and stop locking up people for taking drugs, that would free up hundreds of billions of dollars at the state, local, and federal level, which we could then use to make this a fairer society, and as we did it, alleviate that anger on the part of white guys.
We're speaking right now with former U.S. Representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Barney Frank about his career or current politics? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with former U.S. Representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.
And you can join in. Do you have a question for Barney Frank about his career or the current state of politics in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Representative Frank, you've said that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is by far the Republican's strongest potential candidate for 2016. What do you see at him? What do you see in him, I should say, that puts him at the top of the pack for you?
An absence of negatives. He is a very right-wing guy. He may not have started out that way, but he's carrying out a very right-wing agenda. This assault on unions in particular is very dangerous. It is not an accident that we have seen inequality increase and the position of working people deteriorate at the same time that the Republicans have been successful in attacking unions. And Walker does not look or come across as conservative as he is. I'm not worried about a Ted Cruz. A candidate who scares children isn't going to be the guy who's going to win. I think Walker has a kind of surface amiability. He's not the most impassioned speaker, but that works to his advantage in a general election. So as I said, I think he is the very conservative guy who shows it the least, and that makes him the most dangerous.
And in terms of what Democrats would need to do to beat him, what would you say needs to be done?
Let people know what he really believes and what he really thinks. One of the real problems that working class and middle class people have is the inability of their children to get a decent education. What Walker is doing to this great institution, the University of Wisconsin, is a terrible thing. And people ought to understand what that would mean in terms of, look, there are two elements that we need to reduce inequality. Short term, to try and get some revenue into people. Longer term, to better prepare people to get the kind of jobs that will pay better. Attacking the university is a very serious interference with that. The right to work laws, which have only one purpose, which is to weaken unions. And I know it's interesting that they say, oh, well, right to work is really good for the workers. Well, then why do they want to exempt police officers? Are they mad at police officers? You know, that's an obvious hypocrisy. So I think we have to make clear exactly how conservative he is. And there are a couple of specifics. Obviously, I have an interest in the financial reform bill. It should be made very clear to people. That's popular. The Republicans are trying to undermine it, but they won't take it on head on. Because the people want financial reform. They understand how badly we suffered from total lack of regulation. We should be very clear that if the Republicans win the presidency in 2016, that's the end of financial reform. Even if they don't get majorities in both houses to repeal it, they will appoint the kind of deregulating regulators who will make it meaningless. So I that's a very important issue that will be between the two parties in 2016. Do you want to go back to a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that won't protect consumers? Do you want unregulated derivatives rocketing around the society and causing these crises? And there will be a cut in health care. And finally, very important, I think, for younger people, forget about any serious effort on the part of the American people if Scott Walker was president to deal with climate change. That is a disastrous policy to take. And so no financial regulation, no climate change, an assault on public education, anti-union. That makes up a pretty good package of things, I think, that people should object to. And finally, I assume he is in sync with his fellow Republican Paul Ryan, weakening Medicare. One of the great, you know, Social Security and Medicare are the two greatest anti-poverty programs in American history.
And I want to go to a caller now. And we're talking a little bit about health care there in your answer. Let's go to Brad in Plover. Brad, hi.
Hi. Senator, you were against this strategy 5 years ago. But in hindsight, don't you think Obama and the Democrats would have gotten a better deal if they had started health care negotiations by first putting single payer on the table and then negotiating down from there? Instead, your side didn't even start negotiations with a public option.
All right, thank
you. Sir, you don't understand. I have to say, you don't understand negotiations. Yes, many of us were for a single payer. We didn't have the votes. People have a somewhat naive view of game theory in which the two sides have to negotiate. We did not have, look, most of us were for single payer on the Democratic side. But not enough. So, yes, many of us, we had a bill to do single payer. We were in favor of it. Many of us wanted to do a public option. Of course we discussed it. We just didn't have the votes. There's a kind of a mechanistic view of game theory that the more you start out with in your demands, the better off you'll be in the end. No, that's not true. Escalating your demands beyond what you have the votes for doesn't make the other people move because they know what you have the votes for. Let me put it on the other way. If the Republicans had started out by saying, let's abolish Medicare, would they have been able to hold us back more? No. So it is simply, as I said, an unrealistic view of game theory and of negotiation to think that if you start out with making demands that you don't have the votes for, you somehow intimidate the other side or influence them. I wish it were that easy, but it isn't.
Representative Frank, you retired from politics in 2013, which makes this interview now different than lots of the ones we do with other politicians, in that you can say whatever it is you like at this point. And in heading out on your current book tour now, is there anything that you've really wanted to say to the country, to people that you couldn't say while you were in office?
Pretty much no. I generally said what I wanted to say. I always felt a little unfairly treated by Fox News, or surprise, surprise, because they used to criticize me for being too blunt and outspoken and being, when people attacked me, attacking back. And then along came Chris Christie, and they thought that was wonderful. at the time, under stress, I would tend to gain weight, and I thought they were guilty of maintaining a double standard for rude fat guys. It was okay if you were conservative, not if you were liberal. But there was one area that I did not want to discuss publicly, and that's my religiosity. I'm Jewish. Being Jewish is obviously both an ethnicity, membership in a communal group, and a religion.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. I wish we had more time. Representative Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Representative Barney Frank from Massachusetts. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.